Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the environment and the 2020 race for president. According to recent polling, the majority of Americans believe the environment is not in good shape and think the federal government should do more. Presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden is hoping to capitalize on this shift in attitudes. He's releasing plans and working to attract support from the liberal wing of the party, which cares deeply about these issues. This in sharp contrast to President Trump. He's rolled back environmental regulations and continues to call climate change a hoax. David Roberts covers energy and climate change for Vox.com. I spoke with him Monday afternoon. David, let's talk about climate change policy, because it certainly seems to be more and more of an issue for voters. But you say for presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden, you call it a sweet spot. Talk about what you mean.
Sure. Well, the politics of climate change in terms of U.S. public opinion has changed quite a bit. I think traditionally in sort of like centrist or establishment Democratic circles, it was sort of seen as a liberal issue that you make a few concessions to, wave your hands at to keep the left base happy. And then, your real campaign is elsewhere. But what the polling has shown lately is first that, of course, among Democrats, it's just a higher and higher salience issue, a higher and higher priority. But polls are also finding that, there's an interesting poll out of Data for Progress not that long ago that found that among wavering Trump voters, which isn't a large number of Trump voters, but there are some, among wavering Trump voters, his positions on climate change and immigration that they are most wavering on. So climate change, actually, among young Republicans, it's really only among the conservative Republican base that is just foursquare opposed to this stuff. Even younger and more moderate Republicans now want action or open to action. So it's a way for Joe Biden to both please his base and get youth enthusiasm and youth excitement, and to reach out to independents and moderates and wavering Trump voters. It's kind of a win-win at this point, which is a real inversion of how climate politics has usually read in U.S. politics.
Now, putting aside potential wavering Trump voters, doesn't he need, just generally speaking, progressive voters and quite young voters?
Yes, that's right. It's interesting. He won the primary without them, basically. So, a lot of people were saying throughout the primary, Warren gets all the hype or Sanders gets all the hype. A lot of young, sort of the young active online voters were enthusiastic about other people. And Biden just kind of plugged away through them with his strength among moderates and especially older African-American voters. But he won't be able to win the general the same way. He needs the young Democrats who will be out enthusiastically stumping for him. And climate is a perfect way to get them without losing anyone else.
So is climate very different then from, say, healthcare for those young and progressive voters? Is it less controversial?
I would say for the young, impassioned voters, everything is a very big deal. I would say the difference is more on Biden's end. The healthcare difference between Biden and the base is longstanding. It was legislated a million times. It came up at every debate. They're sort of dug in on either side of those. But in terms of climate, Biden doesn't have any real dug in position. He's always sort of proven willing to kind of go where the winds blow. So in terms of things that he's capable of moving on, climate's a much better sort of bargaining chip for him.
So if you can give us an overview of Biden's plans that he laid out on the climate last week.
Sure. And it's important sort of as background for this to say that among sort of the broad left of center in U.S. politics, there's been over the last just 2 or 3 years, a real alignment forming around climate policy. So it used to be very contentious. The lefties used to hate the centrists, and you know, the centrists wanted a carbon tax and the lefties wanted other things. But lately, the left has more or less unified around a climate policy vision. And so it was very easy for Biden, you know, Biden's initial climate plan that he released months ago was pretty weak. But this new one is basically reflects that alignment, that new consensus. And so the three pillars of that I describe are standards, investments, and justice. So standards means when it comes to cars, buildings, power plants, you know, tight emission standards that decline down to zero by mid-century. And then investments means $2 trillion in investments over 4 years in green infrastructure, you know, electric car charging, high voltage transmission lines, all this stuff, lots and lots of building, which means lots and lots of jobs. And so the justice angle is just all of the standards and all of the investments are done through the lens of environmental justice. So the most vulnerable communities get the first cut at the revenue. Every regulation almost has a little clause or something that says, and we're going to assess the results every few years to make sure that it's not unduly impacting vulnerable communities. So there's a real, you know, sort of environmental justice has gone from being sort of an add-on to really infusing the whole plan. And all of that is a result of left organizing and advocacy.
What happens to the old terms like cap and trade? Where did they go?
Well, the fight over putting a price on carbon, either through a cap and trade program or through a straight up carbon tax, is longstanding and very heated in climate politics. But lately, it's just kind of faded to the background. I think there's a new consensus that says that putting a price on carbon, either through cap and trade or a carbon tax, is fine. It's good. Better to have it than not have it. But it's not a silver bullet. It's not sort of like the one true policy that once you get that, you can relax, right? It's one tool in the toolbox. And it's there in a lot of the Democratic sort of recommendations and plans. It's just not the headline anymore.
So however they do it, I would think, as you put it, the devil is going to be in the details.
I would locate the devil somewhere slightly different. The details of the plan going into an election are neither here nor there. What's going to matter is the details once we see what politics looks like in 2021, right? So does Biden have Congress? If he has Congress, how big of a majority in Congress? And if he has a majority in the Senate, is he going to get rid of the filibuster or find out some way to pass legislation over Mitch McConnell's objections? So it's those political realities that will ultimately shape how the details play out, not kind of how they envision them in a plan beforehand. It's going to be the grinding of the political gears that shape the actual plan that, you know, manifests.
I was interested that Biden specifically mentions the importance of union jobs. How come?
Yeah, the whole, and I wrote a long piece about this before Biden came out with his plan, about this alignment on the left around climate policy. And one of the things it's trying to do is bring together groups on the left that have traditionally sort of been in tension with one another over these issues. And so the big one is unions, right? Unions have, especially the sort of heavy trade unions, have traditionally been an oppositional force on climate policy because they have lots of jobs in fossil fuel, you know, infrastructure, and those are pretty good jobs. And so figuring out a way for unions into this, a way that they can support this, was an important piece of that. So you get unions, environmental justice, and then you need moderates in Congress, and then you need the enthusiastic sort of youth climate advocates. You have to get all those groups on the same page. And it turns out the way to get unions in is just jobs, jobs, jobs. It's just spend a lot of money, create a lot of jobs. And again, with the standards, make sure that anyone who gets, you know, one of these jobs, it's required to have certain work and health and et cetera standards. These are good jobs, right? Because right now, jobs in the renewable energy industry and jobs in clean energy generally, it's just a reality that they're not as good as fossil fuel jobs, they're way less likely to be unionized. They pay less, et cetera, et cetera. So I think everyone on the left has finally come around to realizing if we want unions on board, we have to get serious about making these good jobs. So that's a huge focus throughout the plan.
So you would talk about then making solar and wind energy jobs, unionized jobs.
That's right. Like the way Washington State did it, Washington State passed a big climate bill a couple of years ago, and they have big tax incentives for clean energy projects. But the way they set it up is it's tiered. So you can only get the full amount of the credit if you have a work plan and unionized jobs. And there's sort of like, you can get 75% of the credit if you, there's like job quality standards. So in Washington, if you want all this public money they're spending, you have to boost the quality of the jobs you're using. And already we're seeing in Washington State, two big solar projects started recently, or maybe a solar and a wind project, I don't recall off the top of my head, but both are unionized, which is a new thing. So it can work, right? The states, this is true of all Biden's climate policy. A lot of this stuff has been tried and tested, road tested in the states and proven to work. And so it's not speculative and sort of airy-fairy anymore. It's a lot of things that we know can be done.
So interesting watching Trump yesterday or Sunday on with Chris Wallace in the interview talking about how he, Trump, feels as though or proclaims that Biden will take away your job and break down the economy and so on. I wondered if you saw it or if you heard portions of it, what your reaction to that was.
Well, I heard clips from it, but if you've heard any Republican talk about any environmental policy any time in the last 30 years, you've heard that same message. It doesn't change. It doesn't change with circumstances. It doesn't change with the kind of policy Democrats put forward. That's just what they say. Like, Trump doesn't know what that means. He doesn't understand what Biden's proposing. He doesn't understand climate policy. Just, it's going to raise prices and cost jobs is what Republicans say anytime Democrats want to regulate anything. So, I mean, I don't know how seriously to take it. It's not like he's got numbers and analysis to back it up. It's more of a tick, a verbal tick than it is an actual critique.
So what about progressives? How are they reacting to what Biden is talking about in regard to climate change?
I've been a little bit nervous about this, kind of wondering whether it would work. But, you know, as I said, his initial plan he put out way months ago in the before times was pretty weak. Like the Sunrise Movement, the youth climate movement, gave him an F minus for his initial plan, which, you know, we can debate whether that was fair, but it was not favored. And when he won the nomination, said, I realize I need a stronger climate plan. I'm going to start reaching out to groups and listening to what they say. And by all indications, his campaign reached out and genuinely had conversations and talked, you know, and you saw this with the sort of Biden Sanders unity task force across the board, but it's true on climate too. It appears that he genuinely reached out, genuinely learned, and adjusted his policy so that it's actually strong and credible. So we're in kind of an unprecedented situation now where not everyone, you know, you never unify the left, but it's kind of the big groups on the left are on the same page on climate policy and behind their candidate, which is just, as someone who's been following, you know, climate policy for 20 years, it is a highly unusual and unprecedented situation for the sort of bag of cats that is the left to be singing from the same hymn book now. Sort of, it's a weird situation. Everyone likes the plan.
And does that include Democratic moderates?
Yes. I mean, as I was saying before about this sort of a policy alignment, if you look at the climate bills that the Democrats in Congress, through the usual committee process, you know, propose, I'm talking about the House, of course, the Senate's not doing anything, but in the House, there's been several climate bills proposed, and they too, more or less, reflect the same standards, investments, and justice. You know, it's sort of, the moderates are on that page as well. So they see the investments, they see the jobs, right? They love the idea of being able to tell their constituents that a bunch of new building and jobs will come to their districts if this is passed. I've yet to hear kind of prominent Democratic voice that is upset about this, that is, you know, that sort of rejects this. There are some voices on the far left, of course, who say this is good, but we need more, right? That's kind of their, yeah, what they say. but no one, I'm not aware of anyone who's just says, oh, I hate this. It's not good. It's weirdly, everyone's on the same page and singing from the same hymnal.
And at the same time, it would seem that Donald Trump has worked very hard to roll back virtually every effort that Barack Obama put into place. So it's not only going to be an effort to create new, but to somehow catch up with what's happened in the last nearly 4 years.
Yes, I think that's a really good point. I mean, I'm not sure that Democrats are as aware of this as maybe they ought to be, but it's a wreckage. The federal government and the agencies are just a wreckage. Their regulations, their staff, the morale, like the entire federal government has just been kind of drained by this. So there's going to be a lot of work required just to get things working again, just to get the EPA competent again and staffed again. This is also a story that doesn't get enough attention, but a lot of these rollbacks that Trump is initiating are being rejected by courts. Like, he's lost, I think, more than 90% of the court cases that have faced him on these rollbacks. So there's been a lot of sort of hue and cry and the appearance of rolling back a lot of things, but very little of it is actually sticking, right? It's being rejected by courts. It's still going to take work to put them back in place, and a lot of them will need to be strengthened. But yes, I think everyone is conscious, and I think Biden is conscious, that for his administration, more than I think even for usual, staffing is a huge deal, hugely important. He's going to need really good people in the agencies to improve their morale, to restaff them, and just to get rules back in place before you even start the process of strengthening rules, right, and expanding them. You just got to fix the government.
Wouldn't you think that if the Republicans at some point during the campaign begin to recognize the environment as something that's appealing to a broad swath of society, that they would somehow get on board to try to at least gain the appearance of doing something worthwhile?
Well, that's precisely what they are doing. They are working to create the appearance that they are doing something. I mean, the process you're talking about is happening. They have seen the polls too. The polls about this are pretty clear. They've been pretty consistent for a while. They know, or at least the sort of wiser heads among them know, that this policy of just sort of foursquare opposition to everything on climate is not a long-term success. So they are right now groping around trying to find a new stance. And the new stance is, I don't know if you've heard them talk about innovation, but what they want to say now is, oh, we can't solve this problem by government taxing anyone or regulating anyone, because taxing and regulating, we know, are evil. But the government can give companies money to innovate new products. So that's their climate policy. And you look, like, what companies will they give money to innovate? Oh, it turns out to be giant oil and gas companies that they're paying to innovate on ways that they can continue burning carbon, but just bury the emissions. So substantively, they've got almost nothing policy-wise, but it's notable that they are trying, right? They're trying to back away from the denialism and adjust to something more like, we recognize the problem, but, you know, the left is too extreme, that sort of middle ground. There's just not a lot of policy acumen or knowledge on that side of the aisle anymore, so they don't really know what they're doing. They're kind of flailing around and embarrassing themselves, but they will. You'll see over coming years, they'll come up with some sort of climate policy counter line that's not just denial, because they don't want to lose all their young people.
But you see, or you believe, that whatever that policy is, it would involve using more of gas and oil rather than less.
The climate policy that they are trying to design is, what can we do that looks like climate policy, but that doesn't hamper or regulate or tax fossil fuels in any way? Because ultimately, their alliance with fossil fuels is primary here, and the climate concern is secondary. But the problem is the sort of space of climate policy that doesn't bother fossil fuel companies is pretty small. The sort of goal that Biden has put and that the IPCC, the international organization, has put and that other countries are starting to come around to accepting is net zero emissions by 2050. That's kind of the standard IPCC goal now. It's what Biden and all the Democrats are targeting. It's what other countries are targeting. And it's just the case that if you want to get to net zero by 2050, you need radical, rapid action that is definitely going to disturb fossil fuel companies. So Republicans are in a box now. You know, they're sort of stressed on two different sides. They have to do something about climate change because young people want it, but they can't, you know, disturb their fossil fuel allies. So they're kind of trying to figure out what they can do to satisfy both those sides. And it's just not going to last.
More of my conversation with David Roberts when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with David Roberts. He writes about energy and climate change for Vox.com. David, do you see any link, any research to a link between climate change and the COVID virus?
Yeah, there's a couple of different links you could draw. One, just on a kind of physical basis. It's one of the well-known results of climate science that a warming atmosphere is going to make pandemics more common. So, I mean, one way to look at COVID is sort of a preview of things to come. I mean, climate change is never going to come down and say, hi, I'm climate change. It's always through drought or migrations or disease. And there's just going to be more and more of those. So this is, in that sense, it's a preview of things to come. And also another, I think, parallel is COVID is a very clear example of a problem that you can't solve on the sort of individualistic, nationalistic, you know, everybody's an island, every country's an island mentality. The only way to solve a collective problem like this is through collective action and sort of collective sacrifice. You know, we're all going to put up with the hassle of masks for a while for the long-term goal of getting rid of this thing. It requires some collective action and some collective trust and solidarity. And so you're seeing we're not very good at that, right? America is not very good at that right now. It's become a very sort of me, entrenched. Like we can't even force ourselves to wear masks for a while. So I think, again, it's just a preview of things to come on climate change. On climate change, you can't solve climate change as an individual country. You've got to have some global solidarity, some cooperation and coordination among countries. And we've got to learn to do that again, or we're just going to see failures like our COVID failure over and over and over again.
So here I sit in Washington, D.C., where temperatures have been 90 or above for more than 20 days. And I know we've broken a record here, but you wonder whether this isn't a portent of things to come. And I recognize weather and climate are different.
Yeah, really one of the more interesting branches of climate science these days and sort of robust branches of climate science is the science of attribution, which is starting to tie weather events to climate change. And actually, science has gotten much, much better at that than it used to be. So it's actually, you know, this sort of thing like weather and climate are completely separate. It's true, but where the connections between them are being more and more illuminated by science. And so we are getting pretty good at saying things like, you know, this heat wave is sort of X% stronger than it otherwise would have been, right? We're actually getting pretty good at that. And so, yeah, we can tie these things to climate change, but it raises a different question, which is the first time you experience something anomalous and unusual like this heat wave, it's salient to you, right? Because it's unusual and you sort of think, what's going on? Let's do something about this. But what about the second time you get an anomalous, weird heat wave? And then the third time you get one, what sort of social science shows is each time it happens, it just becomes less remarkable. It just becomes less noticeable. And so you don't get activated. And so it becomes hard to ever find that kind of trigger point that gets people activated and out on the streets and demanding action on this, because it's just incremental creeping and we just get used to it.
We get used to it and it becomes part of simply the way things are.
You can even see that happening now around the virus. Like, it's never mind over years with climate change, it's happening over months with the virus. We're on the verge of getting used to thousands of people dying every day. We're on the verge of getting used to just not being able to be with each other. Like, that's just the thing now. Like, you can see how fast this process of accommodation takes place. And it's a real challenge for the politics.
A real challenge for politics and politicians, it would seem, would be a combination of these phenomena of weather events and the COVID coming together. How is that likely to perhaps affect the minds of swing voters, those two elements put together?
Everything's become a mystery to me. I don't have any idea what swing voters are thinking anymore. I mean, look out at this just sort of like unrelenting chaos. I have a weird view on it because, you know, it's my job to follow all of it all the time. So it's like all in my head. But if I'm just an average sort of partially disengaged casual news consumer, what out of this madness is penetrating? What sense am I making of it? The COVID and the climate and the sort of rising authoritarianism and what is the narrative being stitched together among ordinary people about what's going on? I genuinely don't know. You can see in the polls that they're sick of it, right? They're definitely turning away from Trump because they're tired of the chaos. But I don't really know what meaning people are going to make of this era. It's a real mystery.
On climate, David, are we up against a now or never situation?
No, I don't like using that kind of rhetoric because, you know, the IPCC, when it sets these goals, like you must, you know, get here by 10 years, here by 2050, they're just saying, I mean, those goals are sort of backfitted from trying to avoid warming of more than 1.5 degrees from pre-industrial levels. So there's nothing magic about 1.5 degrees. Like if it goes to 1.6, we're still all here. We've still got the problem, like, or 1.7. Any less is better than any more. So even if we're going to go up to 2 or 3, it's still better to stop there than to keep going to 4. So there's no ever finished with this job, right? We absolutely need to start now. But even if we don't, we need to start as soon as possible and work for the rest of our lives at it.
But isn't there some point at which plants stop growing, food stops growing, trees begin to die, water dries up? When you say you could keep going, I mean, surely there does come a point where our Earth is no longer habitable.
Yeah, I worry that some of the rhetoric has gone a little overboard, that people think that's so much of a kind of a live or pressing option. The chances of global warming getting so out of control that it results in us literally going extinct are very, 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 very slim. Like there are, it's not zero, right? There are tail risks out there that could make things go really horribly bad. And we don't necessarily know where those triggers are. So we don't want to go testing it, right? Because we don't have any other planet to experiment with. But most likely we're heading now, most of the scientists and models think we're heading now toward somewhere between 3 and 4 degrees of temperature rise from pre-industrial levels. That will be bad. It will be very bad, but not extinction bad. It will just be chaos and migration and slower, maybe even reversed economic growth and you know, sort of the growth of poverty. It's absolutely worth avoiding. But out on that sort of tail end where you get extinction, that's pretty unlikely. But like what we're heading toward is plenty bad enough to worry about.
Aren't we already seeing some animal extinction?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's difficult to disentangle the causes of animal extinction. We're eating up their habitat is a big thing. There's air pollution. I mean, it's mostly habitat loss and farming and cutting down forests and things like that, but also it's climate. So it's very difficult to distinguish why, but yes, the rate of extinctions is extremely higher right now than it typically is. There's some debate about whether we should call this the sixth great mass extinction, but whether you call it that or not, we are rapidly wiping out other species. And if things get bad on climate, there are, you know, models that show that we could wipe out, like, you know, more than half of the species that now exist on the Earth, which is really difficult to wrap your mind around. It's not, I think that fact just kind of bounces off people, but, you know, like humanity inherited an incredibly biodiverse and rich world, which was incredibly rich and biodiverse right up until a couple of centuries ago, and have just really rapidly wiped out a lot of habitat and a lot of other species, and we're just heading rapidly in that same direction. So that's going to continue. And I think that's worth worrying about. The sort of the good news, I don't know if it's good, but the quasi good news is a lot of the solutions to habitat loss, to species loss, to climate change, to air pollution, a lot of these solutions overlap. So a lot of the same things need to be done to address a lot of these problems, and sustainable development goals like reducing poverty and increasing, you know, education and all that kind of stuff. A lot of these things overlap into the same set of policies. So we know what we need to do, and we can sort of solve multiple problems at once if we get to it.
David, before we close, is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners?
Yeah, I guess the one thing I would say about climate politics in the U.S., and I don't know if this is properly understood, is consumers of political news in the U.S. are so used to hearing there's this side and that side. This side wants this, that side wants that. It's a two-sided thing, you know, both sides, blah, blah, endlessly. So they see everything in these weird 50-50 terms. But if you broaden your lens and look at the whole world, you'll see that almost everyone on this issue, on climate change, almost everyone is on the side of our Democrats, right? Like, even conservative parties in other countries are doing more on climate change than our Democrats are, much less our Republicans. So this is not a 50-50 thing. The position of the conservative Republican base on this issue is anomalous globally, like substantively. It's just, they are isolated in this. It's not a respectable standard position around the world. It's a very weird phenomenon that is mainly in the US and Australia and the UK, mainly driven by these very wealthy right-wingers who fund these political campaigns. So it's not a 50-50 thing. If you're on Joe Biden's side on climate change and the climate change plan he put forward, you are on the side of the vast majority of the US population and the vast majority of the global population, right? You're not taking some far out stance here. Everybody in the world is getting together around this, and our US Republican Party is anomalous even among conservative parties in being so ignorant and oppositional about this.
David, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I had fun.
And that's all for today. Before I close, a word about my dear friend, John Lewis, congressman who died Friday. He was brave, he was fearless, and he was powerful. He was also one of the kindest people I've ever known. I will miss him. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg, and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, and please do wear those masks. I'm Diane Reed.